Previously on Beta.
Mary usually does the carving, but maybe tonight you'll do it, Henry. All right with you?
I'd like an omelet, plain, and a chicken salad sandwich on wheat toast. No mayonnaise, no butter, no lettuce, and a cup of coffee.
The truth is, you're the weak, and I'm the tyranny of evil men.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Does it seem like people are ruder these days? Danny Wallace sure thinks so. Take, for example, the hot dog incident.
I don't know if you've ever walked in somewhere and the person behind the counter already seems to have taken against you for some reason.
We explore the new rudeness movement in a polite and civil manner. Also, Nafisa Thompson-Spires joins us to talk about her new short story collection, Heads of the Colored People.
I felt for a long time that there's been a very limited sense of what counts as authentically Black. People like to use the phrase the Black community or the Black experience as though there's this monolithic linear experience that everyone has, and it's just not true.
And Chuck Klosterman puts on his Beta lab coat for a rock and roll thought experiment. Let's kick things off with Dana Schwartz. She's only 25, but she's already written a memoir. It's called Choose Your Own Disaster. In it, she revisits all of the bad decisions she made in her early 20s. And if you think it seems strange to write a memoir that young, Dana would agree with you.
Gosh, it seems so strange saying memoir. Like, I feel like it should have an S on it. Like, I wrote my memoirs. Like, okay. I'm like some French philosopher. So I don't really, like, think of it like I wrote my memoirs, plural. More just I had stories from my life that were funny and embarrassing and sometimes hard to write and talk about. And I figure that if I could maybe share them, they would be relatable and help some people. So it's less like I wrote my memoirs at 25, which makes me want to stab myself. And more like these are just some essays of things that happened in my life from 21 to 23.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, and then quite a few exciting things happened to you between 21 and 23. So as the title Choose Your Own Disaster indicates, your book is structured like one of those Choose Your Own Adventure children's games books in which the reader adopts the role of the protagonist and then makes choices that determine the actions that the main character makes, and consequently that determines the plot of the book. Why did you want to use this structure?
To me, being in your early 20s or late teens is this part of your life when you can sort of become whatever version of yourself you want to be, especially in this age of like self-marketing and self-promoting, when people like create quote-unquote personal brands, which is like a phrase that literally exists now.
Yeah.
People brand themselves in certain ways and identify certain types of people. And I think self-perception influences then the actions you go on to take. So I thought that looking back at my early 20s, so much of the mistakes I made, the right and wrong decisions I made, was based less on the person I actually was and more on the person I wanted to be. So that was what really informed the choose-your-own-adventure structure, that people are choosing the version of themselves that they're sort of trying to become in their early 20s, and that influences their behavior. And also, I was inspired by sort of this fixation we have on sorting ourselves and categorizing ourselves. I think young adult novels particularly, like anything from like Harry Potter to Divergent, there's this pattern of sorting, like the process of sorting, like you're a Gryffindor, you're a whatever like the Divergent categories are. Like people like want labels for themselves in certain ways, especially when you're like a teenager and don't know who you are. You're like, oh, I'm a Ravenclaw. This is who I am. I'm this type of personality. And so I was fascinated sort of by that impulse. And that was also what inspired me to use this structure.
Yeah, because it's like when people are young, they're looking for their identity and trying on these different identities. And as you mentioned, branding just looms so large in our culture. So you have things like a character that you have fun with at the beginning of your book is fake rom-com lady.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking it would be cool to try using this same choose your own adventure structure during the interview. Turn it into kind of a choose your own interview experiment for a bit. If this sounds like something you'd be interested in pursuing, answer yes. Or if you'd rather proceed with the traditional old fashioned type of interview, answer no.
So let's do option A.
Okay, yes. All right, excellent. So you include two epigraphs at the beginning of your book. If you'd like to talk about the Charles Dickens epigraph, please say Charles Dickens. Or if you'd like to talk about the Tom Stoppard epigraph, please say Tom Stoppard.
Oh, Tom Stoppard, definitely. The reason that I included a Tom Stoppard epigraph from his amazing play, Arcadia, one, because the themes of the play, which are that, you know, fate and time are predetermined in some way, and the only thing that screws up the perfect order of the universe is people falling in love with the wrong people, seemed very, very fitting to my early 20s.
Yeah.
But also, when I was a junior in college, I directed a college production of Arcadia, and I think it was like the best experience of my life. One, because I'm obsessed with that play, so any excuse that let me read it twice a day for, you know, 8 weeks, I was happy. But it also gave me that same sense of belonging and community and purpose. I felt it was the first time really where I felt really creatively fulfilled in that group. And that experience really propelled me down the arts. It made me feel comfortable and established. Also, I live in LA now, but I would say the only time I've ever gone up to a celebrity in public and just fawned, which I'd never do because it's rude. They're just trying to live their life. But I saw the actor who played Septimus in the original Broadway production of Arcadia, and I was just like, oh, my God, I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but I'm such a fan.
Yeah, as you write at one point in your book with that celebrity thing, you have 12 seconds where you can make a decision about whether you're going to approach them, right?
Yeah, you don't want to stare at them too long and be weird about it.
Yeah, yeah. If you think that this Choose Your Own Adventure idea is compromising the energy, flow, and pace of the conversation and would like to abandon it, answer yes. Or if you think that this Choose Your Own Adventure idea still has legs and would like to continue with it, answer let's stick with it.
Oh, let's stick with it. Hit me with another question.
Okay, you called my bluff on that. So
I was going to say, as you learn from this book, hopefully, I'm like an incredibly impulsive and experimental person, and I'll try anything. And
I always like
to go for the weirder option and things.
So that concludes our interview adventure. Now we'll just go old school kind of thing. One of the things you're famous for is your parody Twitter profile, Guy in Your MFA. How did that come about?
Yeah, so actually, I was a pre-med college student, and so I, for like my entire college experience, I actually entered college as a physics major and then went into biology and worked in like labs for a really long time. And then senior year, I sort of had this Jewish come to Jesus moment where I was like, I will not be happy doing this. I was doing it for all the wrong reasons. If you're sort of good at science and relatively smart, you're like, well, this is what I should be doing with a capital S. But the way med school works is if you don't really love it, it's a long and expensive process for a life that would make you happy.
Yeah.
So my senior year, I went to Brown, which is really lucky because they let you sort of select any classes you want outside of a curriculum.
Yeah.
And I realized that when I didn't have to take classes, I was always selecting history and English classes. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that's probably a sign.
Yeah.
And my senior year, I was in a fiction writer's workshop, and I had a stack of other student stories to read. And they were, I think, like 4 out of the 5 of them were about like an unnamed man leaving a woman on a train, like abandoning his life on his train on a train because he's so complicated.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I was going through this crisis with my future, and I was considering going into an MFA program and researching it and sort of going into the internet community of those worlds. And I, for fun, I dipped into that persona, sort of every writer's worst impulses, and made Guy in Your MFA, which just indulges the most masculine, pretentious impulses of fiction writing.
One of my favorites is, "Oh, hello there. I didn't hear you over my Bon Iver on vinyl." That's great. That's
based on a true story.
Yeah, yeah. And is it? Yeah. And that's red meat for us out here in Wisconsin. Yeah. So another one, my second favorite, well, they're not in any order, but another one is, I'm sure every girl at this bar wants to hear my incredibly detailed thoughts about Jonathan Franzen.
Yes. 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 And for any men listening, the girl at the bar who looks like she's not interested definitely wants to hear your thoughts on Jonathan Franzen.
Yeah, the more disinterested they look, the more interested they actually are.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Of course, yeah. So coming in at number three, the real struggle in air quotes, the real struggle is trying to explain the nuances of Knausgård to you if you've only read him in translation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think my other favorite, and I'm going to paraphrase because I don't have it in front of me, but I like that this character has a fixation on Jonathan Franzen, like mm-hmm. this love, hate, jealousy. And I think I have one that's something to the effect of, I read Jonathan Franzen's The Corrections. Let's just say I had a few corrections.
That's great. Yeah, I don't know how I missed that one. Thank God you remembered that one. Yeah, and I gotta do this one because this one is another favorite, being the coffee addict that I am. Coffee, black like fresh tar on a city street. Done hasty and rough by men with nothing to live for and everything to lose.
Yeah, that sentence appears in every one of his novels.
Yeah.
The thing is, like, Guy Near MFA and Dystopian YA Tweets, I sort of now view as like a almost a completed work. Like, I don't yeah. really go back and tweet from those accounts anymore, really, because I am busy and I think I've drained those wells sufficiently. So I would say anyone who wants a peek into my broken brain, my personal Twitter account is the place to go. But I also don't view Twitter as like my primary art form, in the sense that I just like tweet whatever dumb idea pops into my head with no thoughts mm-hmm. or editing. Like mm-hmm. my dad sometimes emails me and he's like, you had a typo in this tweet. And I was like, oh, I don't care. That's not.
Yeah, that's not the point.
I don't know. Like I almost get sad when people correct my tweets or like want to read into them anything other than like I was sad at 11:30 at night while I was in bed and eating dry cereal like out of a like picture me with like a bowl, but like I'm just leaning my face into it like I'm a horse with a bag of feed.
Yeah.
And that's how I'm tweeting.
Yeah.
And pressing send without thinking.
At times, Choose Your Own Disaster, your book comes across kind of like this manifesto about the millennial experience, modern feminism, and how the supposedly liberating advice that you can be anything you want can often be rather paralyzing instead of liberating. Did you intend your book to have this kind of manifesto quality to it?
Yeah. You know, not, I think manifesto is like a very grandiose word, mm-hmm. but I definitely wanted to capture sort of the sadness of the like capital Y you go girl empowerment, this idea of like you can do anything, you can be a business lady, and I think like the character of the rom-com career girl sort of plays into that. Like,
oh sure,
one thing that made me sadder than anything in my early 20s was trying to be this like perfect feminist empowered woman, like this lady who like slept with whoever she wanted and was sexually empowered and didn't have feelings but also was perfect and at the top of her game. And I think like this, the other edge of that sword is that it puts a lot of pressure on women mm-hmm. to be superhuman in a certain way, both like vulnerable but not pathetic and tough but not off-putting, and trying to be that caricature of a woman made me really, really sad and exhausted.
Yeah. I read somewhere, I can't remember where, but I read that your book is mostly true. Is that?
Yeah.
Yes, but there are some parts that you made up.
Yes. So, I mean, that's part and parcel with the Choose Your Own Adventure, where there are some answers where you'll go to a fictionalized version of a thing that might have happened. I think I've switched, like, in looking, I would say probably, like, 70% is true, and then the rest is all, like, mostly true, like things that I could have imagined happening if I had said or done a slightly different thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes the order of events is switched around.
Yeah, yeah.
Depending on what you choose. And then I would say, like, a few stories are just completely made up, but you probably will be able to tell. I think there is one story where I die getting hit by a piano in the head. So that is not true.
Right.
Also, if my parents read this book, none of it's true. I have plausible deniability.
Well, yeah, I want to ask you about that, because in the acknowledgement, she thanked your sister Caroline, who was the first person to read this book, and you said she needed to help you prevent your parents from reading it. Have they really not read it?
You know, my parents are lovely and incredibly supportive, and I think they've read almost everything I've written. They've read my first novel, And We're Off, and they read almost everything I publish online. They've read excerpts from this, and if they want to take a pass on a few sex scenes or know my fetish proclivities, like, I think that's probably healthy.
Okay, fair enough.
Also, for people who love me and care about me, I think this book might make them a little sad, and I don't want my parents to be sad.
Oh, yeah, that makes total sense. Yeah, I totally get that. Has writing this book changed the way you think about making major life decisions?
Oh, no. Because
no?
I don't think when I make major life decisions.
And it hasn't caused you to think that, hey, maybe I should think about major life decisions.
In a good way, I think one of my best and worst qualities is I'm like a hopeless romantic.
Mm-hmm.
And I always think things are going to work out or be fun or be a good story, which usually they are. And I sort of like masochistically lean into my own heartbreak a lot of the time. But I'm young enough where I feel like I still have like 3 or 4 years of bad decisions in me before I need to turn it around.
Yeah, you have a lot of time. You're only 25, for crying out loud. You have a lot of years ahead of you, several more lifetimes. What do you want readers to take away from reading Choose Your Own Disaster?
Hopefully readers will relate to some things, to like the struggle, and realize that they weren't alone when they were thinking those thoughts that they thought were embarrassing or isolating. I hope that people can talk more openly about like eating disorders and anxiety and depression and things that so many girls go through but are too sort of embarrassed to discuss openly. I hope we can have honest conversations about sex lives and the way that women live and have sex now in 2018. And I hope they take away that this is so corny, but really like in charge of their own destiny. And they don't have to pretend to be anyone.
Yeah.
Because who you are is enough, and also probably cooler and better than who you're pretending to be anyway.
Dana Schwartz is the author of Choose Your Own Disaster. Find out more about Dana at wpr.org/beta. And send us your memoirs or just what you think of the show, or both, in an email to beta@wpr.org.
I'm a big fan of spy notes, and I kind of took the wrong lesson away from Harriet the Spy. I think spy notes can help you do a lot of things as long as you're discreet.
Nafisa Thompson Spires joins us to talk about her new short story collection, Heads of the Colored People. That's next. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta. Nafisa Thompson Spires has a new collection of short stories called Heads of the Colored People. Each of her stories takes us deep into the minds of very original characters, like a funeral singer who grieves for the young black boys who were victims of gun violence. The title of her collection comes from a long-running series of literary sketches that were written in the 19th century by James McCune Smith.
McCune Smith was an abolitionist and a doctor who was publishing these sketches individually in Frederick Douglass's newspapers and trying to think through black citizenship at the time. So he's representing a lot of working class and middle class black people from sketches that range kind of from the macabre to really realistic. But he's really thinking about overall what it would look like for black people to have the full rights of citizenship during that period.
McCune Smith was the first African American to hold a medical degree and the first one to run a pharmacy in the United States. Is that correct?
Right.
So how would you say that your short stories differ from McCune Smith's literary sketches?
Well, the time period is a significant difference, though it's also in some ways not one. When I initially started writing, I thought I would sort of update each of McCune Smith's sketches individually, but that became really restrictive. And what I found was that some things have changed. I mean, black people do have rights on paper, But a lot of the conversations that we're having about voter suppression and whether Black Lives Matter, state-sanctioned violence, all of those things are things that McCune Smith was very much concerned with in his day and that we're still concerned with today.
And also something like police brutality?
Exactly.
What kinds of characters did you want to write about in the 12 stories that make up this collection?
I wanted to write about Black characters that I felt I hadn't seen as much. That's not to say no one's ever written about Black nerds. I wanted to see the kinds of Black characters I felt like I was as a kid in particular. So Black people who were one of the only Black people in a particular space, like a private school, Black kids who weren't considered Black enough, or Black adults who are struggling through white academia. So those were the characters, people who are often read as exceptional in some way or another, whether they are or aren't.
Mm. And the opening story in your collection is the title story, the full title of which is Heads of the Colored People, Four Fancy Sketches, Two Chalk Outlines, and No Apology. Can you tell me a bit about this story?
Yeah. The story came in part from the James McCune Smith sketches, but also some of his contemporaneous writers like Frances Ellen Watkins Harper and William Wilson, and they were all writing these literary sketches at the time for similar reasons. But I wanted to think about this character who came to my head. I just had this idea of Riley wore blue contacts and bleached his hair blonde. That line wouldn't leave me alone for a few days. Mm. And I started trying to figure out who this Riley character was. And it seemed like an easy way to explore him was through cosplay culture and people who are very much into comic books and these conventions and who dress up against racial types, so who are trying to do cross-racial or transracial cosplay. And I'd read articles about Black people getting backlash for doing that. You know, cosplay purists don't want you to dress as an Asian character if you aren't Asian, or if you aren't white, to dress as a white character. And what would it mean to try to operate in those spaces in spite of that tension?
Now would be the perfect time to have you read the opening paragraphs from this story.
Sure. So this is Heads of the Colored People, Four Fancy Sketches, Two Chalk Outlines, and No Apology. Riley wore blue contact lenses and bleached his hair, which he worked with gel and a blow dryer and a flat iron, some mornings into Sonic the Hedgehog spikes so stiff you could prick your finger on them, and sometimes into a wispy side-swooped bob with long bangs. And he was Black. But this wasn't any kind of self-hatred thing. He'd read The Bluest Eye and Invisible Man in school, and even picked up Disgruntled at a book fair. And yes, they were good, and there was some resonance in those books for him. But this story isn't about race or the shame of being alive or any of those things. He was not self-hating. He was even listening to Drake, though you could make it Fetty Wap if his appreciation for trap music changes something for you, because all that's relevant here is that he wasn't against the music of his people or anything like that as he walked down Figueroa with his earbuds pushed in just far enough so as not to feel itchy. Riley was wearing the wispy swooped version of his bangs and listening to Drake or Fetty, and he was Black with blue contacts and bleached blonde hair. And yes, there are Black people who have both of those things naturally, without the use of artificial accoutrement. So we can move past the whole phenotypically this or biologically that discussion to the meat of things. And if there's something meta in this narrator's consciousness and self-consciousness, or this overindulgent aside, it isn't meta for the sake of being meta. This narrator's consciousness is just letting you know about said consciousness up front, like a raised Black fist, to get the close reading out of the way and make space for Riley, who was the kind of Black man for whom blue eyes and blonde hair were not natural. He was the kind of Black that warranted, or invited without solicitation, comparisons to drinks from Starbucks, or lyrics from Lady Marmalade, or chocolate bars with nuts. You would think with his blue contacts and unnaturally blonde hair set against dark chocolate mocha chocolata yaya skin, and yes, there is some judgment in the use of you, that Riley would date white or Asian women exclusively, or perhaps that he liked men. But you'd be wrong on both counts, as Riley was straight and he dated widely among Black women, and he was neither in denial, nor on the down low, nor like John Mayer, equal opportunity in United Colors of Benetton in life, but as separate as the fingers of the hand in sex, nor like Frederick Douglass or many others working on Black rights in public and going home to a white wife. And there's no judgment against Douglass here, just facts for the sake of descriptive clarity. Riley liked Black women, both their Blackness and womanness, and the overlap between those constructs. Nor was Riley queerphobic or the type of man to utter no homo in uncomfortable situations, because Riley was comfortable enough, if enough expresses a sort of educated awareness. There's so much awareness in these two paragraphs that I've hardly made space for Riley, who in addition to Black women liked cosplay, dressing up as characters from his favorite books and movies, Doctor Who and Rurouni Kenshin, and the Comic Love Convention, and especially Death Note, his favorite manga and anime series. And though that day he was dressed as Tamaki Suo per his girlfriend's request, in a skinny periwinkle suit with a skinny black tie, his appearance gave him the flexibility to on other occasions dress as Kisei Ryoto or Naruto, or if he were feeling especially bold, Super Saiyan.
Thank you. That was great. I love your use of meta commentary in this story. You even take it to another level when you write that it isn't meta for the sake of being meta. It's very funny. Why did you want to add this level of meta commentary to the title story?
It's funny. I think meta gets a bad rap among certain kinds of MFA types. In one way, it was just a dig at those types.
Yeah.
But in another way, I think it's a signal that the whole collection itself is doing this other kind of work. So, yes, these are stories, and at their very baseline, they're supposed to be read for entertainment and for pleasure, but they're also art, and they're also social commentary. And I wanted all of those three things to be going on at once and to gesture towards the fact that, you know, every story in here is meta, whether it seems meta or not.
Yeah. I've read that your characters are based on observations of real people and you use methods that you learned from Louise Fitzhugh's classic kids lit character, Harriet the Spy. Is that true?
That is also very true. I'm a big fan of spy notes and I kind of took the wrong lesson away from Harriet the Spy. I think spy notes can help you do a lot of things as long as you're discreet.
And you still do that. You actually have like a spy notebook like she did and you observe people and take notes of things they say?
I have many spy notebooks, yes.
That's great. Yeah, well, that's paying off, isn't it? One of your characters, Fatima, appears in three of the stories. Can you tell me a bit about Fatima and why you wanted to write about her character three times over the course of the book?
It's funny. I had a hard time shaking Fatima, and I'm still writing about her, so my novel in progress is also about her. But I felt that I hadn't finished telling about her by the end of the first story. I initially was trying to write a novel about this character, and I found that it was easier to kind of get at some of her concerns in shorter vignettes, and then eventually those vignettes became a couple of short stories. But I also wanted us to see multiple angles. So in Belletra, for example, we don't really see Fatima. We see her mother talking about her. And then in Fatima the Biloquist, it's the first time that we get kind of a close lens on her, but we have a third-person kind of snarky narrator. And Fatima never got her own voice in either of those stories. So in The Body's Defenses Against Itself, we actually get a first-person account from her about her life. And so I liked that idea of exploring her from these three different points of view, three different angles. And again, I still don't feel like I'm finished thinking through the complications of her life.
One reviewer, David Canfield, says that Fatima's coming of age as a black woman is key to your book. And he wrote that it's, quote, a meditation on the nuances of identity formation and how it's complicated by identity markers, black, affluent, that defy entrenched social structures, end quote. What do you think of that description?
I think it's a strong description. I would add that it's not just the identity markers of class and blackness, but also femaleness. Fatima's struggling a lot with her body in those stories, especially in The Body's Defenses and Fatima the Biloquist. She's living with an undiagnosed illness that really makes her worried about how womanly she is. And that's something that comes up in the novel that I'm working on now even more.
Do you see a lot of yourself in Fatima?
In some ways, yes. We have somewhat parallel upbringings and we both have endometriosis, which is the diagnosis she eventually gets in that story. So, yeah, there's definitely a part of me in Fatima, more than probably any of the other characters in the collection.
Mm. You've said that you hope your stories will help readers, quote, rethink what's allowed as authentically black and what isn't, end quote. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, I think we're getting better all the time in that way because there are so many smart young people who refuse that kind of easy categorization. But I felt for a long time that there's been a very limited sense of what counts as authentically black. That, you know, there's people like to use the phrase the black community or the black experience as though there's this monolithic linear experience that everyone has. And it's just not true. I grew up upper middle class in a really diverse neighborhood and in a really white school and had a hard time moving back and forth between the settings of my neighborhood and my school or my church, which was black. And being told that I wasn't black enough because of the way I spoke or because of the shoes I was wearing or the music I listened to. And that's a lot of people's experience, that particular tastes make them seem less part of that singular black experience. And I want to say the black experience is plural. There are many black experiences and that there are lots of ways that one might experience it. But when it comes down to it, class position, privileges don't sort of accept someone from still encountering violence as a black person. My education, whatever money I had, none of those things kept me from being black, authentically black in a store when a white woman followed me around or any of that. So we're all living the same sorts of oppression, whether we have privilege or not. And the blackness is sort of the common denominator of that. But there are many ways to live that blackness out.
Nafisa Thompson-Spires is the author of the short story collection, Heads of the Colored People.
Look, it's rock and roll!
Thought Experiment
with Chuck Klosterman.
Devo co-founder Mark Mothersbaugh has often described Devo as the thinking man's Kiss. So I'm wondering if that means that Kiss is the stupid man's Devo. I actually asked Mark that question a few years ago and he wouldn't answer. He said,
I'll let you say that.
Of course, I said it. So I've got a feeling that you will answer this question. Is that a fair statement to make, that Kiss is the stupid man's Devo?
Well, you know, I worked in Akron, Ohio for 4 years at the Akron Beacon Journal.
That's
so
right.
Devo is actually something that I spent a lot of time writing about and thinking about. And, you know, the idea of the thinking man's Kiss, you know, there's things about Devo no one knows, or very few people know. One, that, you know, that band was really spawned by the Kent State shootings.
Yes.
That really charged them politically and made them want to do this thing. And also, like, the whole idea of what MTV became, that was their original inception of the band, that we were only going to be visual.
Yeah.
I would say that, you know, that's a pretty good argument. I mean, I won't say, like, okay, I've thought of this 100 times before.
No.
But that would, if somebody had asked me just the question, who is the thinking man's Kiss, I guess I probably would have come up with, like, Devo, maybe Kraftwerk.
Mm.
I suppose the other answer is, you know, the idea of Black Kiss, that was Parliament.
Parliament
Funkadelic.
Yes. Yeah, and they were on the same label, weren't they? They were both on Casablanca.
And I think there was probably a period in like when Parliament was first touring, like with the Mothership, that people would be like, if they're trying to attract a white audience, they would say, like, this is like the Black Kiss. You know? Now, in retrospect, the music of Parliament and the music of Funkadelic is respected so much more. And it is, you know, I think, it, you know, from, like, if you're being a rock critic and trying to be objective, it's really easy to understand why that argument is made. But I think philosophically, there probably is a real similarity there. A band like Devo or a band like the Talking Heads is an interesting counterbalance to a group like Kiss, where the Talking Heads and Devo tried to be primitivists. Like, they wanted their music to seem primitive, and they put a lot of thought into making it feel that way.
Yeah, sort of like Art Brut, right? That movement?
Yeah. Whereas Kiss had very kind of primitive music simply because that was the limitations of their musicality.
Yes.
And this, in some ways, is like the entire description of how rock criticism works. If your music is super simple on purpose, you're a genius. If it's super simple because you haven't played that much, it's terrible.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I think one of the issues that is that, like, Kiss's lyrics are among, like, the dumbest lyrics in the history of rock. Would you agree with that?
Well, here's the deal, though. I would say that there is a charm to that dumbness, though, that you don't get from lyrics that might be, like, a few levels higher.
Mm-hmm.
But Kiss's lyrics are extremely straightforward. I think one thing that always is funny about them is that songs written by Ace Frehley, which, of course, kind of start in the middle period of Kiss and kind of go through Ace's solo career, is he is one of the few songwriters who was never told that a song doesn't have to rhyme. Like, he'll never use slant rhyme.
Yeah.
He'll never use words that kind of, he has to have everything rhyme perfectly. It is sort of like a fourth grader learning how to write a song. And he's like, he knows they're supposed to rhyme or whatever. But, you know, you start talking about, like, you know, the complexity of of music lyrics in general in pop, you know. Mm-hmm. Okay, sure, you know, you have Morrissey, you have, like, the Magnetic Fields, you know, you have these groups where you have to say, like, boy, this is pretty intelligent wordplay or whatever. But for the most part, I think straightforward, sort of brutal, simplistic lyrics work best because people can inject their meaning into it anyway, which is what people want to do.
Oh, sure.
And I don't know if Kiss would be at all improved if their lyric writing was 15% more intellectual. I don't know if that helps the product because they have tried that at times. People laugh at it because they can't hear Kiss without seeing it. Paul Stanley has often said that, like, people hear with their eyes, and I think Kiss kind of proves that.
Chuck Klosterman joined us for a beta rock and roll thought experiment. More rock and more thought.
If you even just witness someone else being rude, you are then much more likely to find rudeness later on in the day and to react to it badly.
Danny Wallace joins us to talk about the hot dog incident. And that's not a jam band. That's next when Beta returns on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta. Do you think people are ruder these days? You're not alone. Danny Wallace thinks that we're experiencing a new wave of rudeness. And Danny decided to investigate this, and he published his findings in a book called F You Very Much, Understanding the Culture of Rudeness and What We Can Do About It. I sat down to have a very polite, very pleasant, and very civil conversation with Danny to find out if we have reached peak rudeness.
Well, I hope we've reached peak rudeness. I hope there's no further we can really go. To me, it feels like the last few years, the world has just got ruder and ruder and ruder. And maybe part of that is because, you know, I'm getting older. But really, the evidence just seems to be tumbling from our phones and coming out of our TVs, and it's on the streets and in the cars. And it really does feel like this is, yeah, a very special time to be a rude person.
Mm-hmm. Is there something in particular you think that's causing this new rudeness?
I suppose there are lots and lots, really. Everybody has to have an opinion on absolutely everything, even if they have no real knowledge to back that opinion up. Having the opinion is the most important thing. And then also broadcasting that opinion to as many people as possible. And it's the rude opinions that really seem to cut through. And, you know, you can point the finger at social media and Twitter and Facebook. But the same is true for columnists who get more clicks, the worse their opinions are. Reality TV that edits mainly the people in who say the rudest and meanest stuff. And all of this establishes a kind of a precedent, if you like, just saying, this is how you get hurt. These are the opinions that you should have. This is how we should be. And the more I looked into it and realized there was a bunch of science behind it as well, the more it seemed to explain how it spreads through our offices and our streets and our schools.
Yeah. Now, you became interested in this subject because of a personal experience you had, something which you refer to as the hot dog incident. What was the hot dog incident?
Yes, it sounds terrifying, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
I was just trying to buy a hot dog. That's all I really wanted. And I've bought hot dogs before. I know how to do it. I'm quite accomplished at buying hot dogs. And my son wanted one as well. And there was a place selling hot dogs. So everything was in place for this very simple transaction to take place.
And this was in Britain. Sorry to interrupt.
This was in Britain. Yeah.
Right, okay.
It was a diner in a little kind of seaside town. And I don't know if you've ever walked in somewhere and the person behind the counter already seems to have taken against you for some reason.
Mm.
Like you turning up to buy a hot dog, even though that's the only reason she got up that morning was to make hot dogs for people like you, is somehow inconveniencing her. And, you know, she made me pay up front as if I was some kind of flight risk. But I was happy to do that. And so we did that. There was nowhere to sit. So we had to stand outside in the wind and the drizzle. And maybe about 15 minutes passed. And, you know, in America, that would be an unacceptable length of time to wait for cooked meat.
Definitely.
But it not being a traditional British dish, you know, we were happy to wait a little while. But after 15 minutes, I thought, well, maybe I should go and say something and just ask. And I did so very politely. I padded in. I had my hands up. I raised my eyebrows. I, I sort of pointed at my son as if it was his fault somehow, like a human shield, just kind of going, I'm just wondering about my son's hot dog. Yeah. And she was furious that I had dared to chase up these hot dogs. She said, you don't understand how it works. We cook to order. There are tables ahead of you. And already I could see that we were on the cusp of something. So I decided to retreat. I went outside, delivered it as if it was good news. Hey, you know, they're on their way. Yeah. You know, they cook to order. But more and more time passed, and I had to go in a couple more times. And to cut a long story very short, after 1 hour and 1 minute of waiting for a hot dog that never arrived, I had to kind of put my foot down a bit. And she accused me of lying and rudely sort of called me out in front of all these people, saying it hadn't been an hour. But luckily I had the receipt because she'd made me pay up front. That was her mistake. So I was able to prove it. And then suddenly we got into this proper argument. Two grown-ups undertaking what should be one of the simplest tasks, you know. And my son is looking up, seeing a man who wants a hot dog and a woman who sells hot dogs not able to politely carry out this very, very simple task. And I ended up getting thrown out of the diner. She sort of threw coins down to scrabble around humiliatingly to pick up my refund. And I'm standing outside looking at my son thinking, how did this happen? How did two people get this so wrong? And when someone is, you know, inexplicably rude to you, it really stays with you. And you know, for me, I became slightly obsessed with it for a couple of days. I couldn't understand why she'd been rude, or I was questioning, had I done something rude? And so, almost as an act of revenge, I decided to analyze that situation and many, many others by talking to as many experts in rudeness and, you know, out of rudeness that I could to establish who was right or wrong that day.
What happened, like, the first day or 2 days after the hot dog incident? Were there any things you did?
Well, I did something insane, which was I found myself driving past that diner the next night, and it was dark and it was empty. It was closed. The streets were deserted. And I found myself, as a grown man, making a very rude hand gesture at a building, which isn't normal. It's not normal behavior.
No.
And I started to wonder why it stayed with me this much. And that's when I decided I was going to investigate it. And one of the first things I did was commission a report. I phoned up a polling company and I put a questionnaire together. And we sent it out to 2,000 adults, just trying to find out where we are so that I could know where we were heading.
Yeah, and you call this survey, appropriately enough, the Wallace Report.
So, yes, I felt that gave it a certain gravitas.
Oh, it very much does. It does. Rather than just a survey, it's the Wallace Report. That's just soaked in gravitas.
Yeah.
So what were the most significant findings of the Wallace Report?
A significant amount of people actually would describe themselves as rude, and they're happy to do that. They're happy to go around thinking, yes, I'm a rude person. I found out that traditionally, when you ask people, who do you think of as rude, so many respondents said that really it's the young. They blame the parents.
Uh-huh.
So you would assume that the people doing most of the rudeness are the young. But when I asked people to think about the last person who'd been significantly rude to them, and then to describe how old they thought they were, it seems like the rudest people tend to be between sort of 35 and 44. So it's the sort of the early middle-aged.
You have this great simile you use to describe the way the new rudeness sweeps across our world. It sweeps across our world the way a drunk clown sweeps across the first row of a circus audience, throwing not delightful buckets of glitter our way, but spraying us with a hose pipe full of his own filth.
Yes, which is quite a rude way of putting it.
Yeah, but that's appropriate.
But I wanted to get across exactly how awful I feel this new rudeness is. And certainly current events haven't helped. The election in America has divided a country straight down the middle, so you've got people kind of at each other's throats. Brexit in Britain has done much the same. Clean divide, almost 50-50 down the middle. And it's got to the point where all you need to do is know how someone voted on one issue 2 years ago to know whether or not you're going to get on. And that has led to people being almost like on a hair trigger. They're just kind of, they're ready to go. They want to have that fight, that argument, and they assume they know everything about the other person.
Yeah. Is it possible that rudeness spreads in the same way that a meme can go viral on the internet?
Yes, absolutely. Scientists have sort of shown that it's almost airborne. It's like a neurotoxin, they call it.
Wow.
And it can spread throughout an office or a workplace, you know, very, very easily. If you even just witness someone else being rude, you are then much more likely to find rudeness later on in the day and to react to it badly, even rudeness where there is none. And we take it home with us as well. If you have a bad day at work, traditionally you think, oh, well, I'll go home, you know, I'll watch some TV, mm-hmm. I'll have a gin and tonic and the world will be great. But actually, it plays on your mind. It messes with the frontal lobes, is the area of the brain that is most affected by rudeness. And that's the part of the brain that deals with working memory and the task at hand. So you find that you're unable to do basic tasks as well as you would on a normal day. They showed that people who just experience rudeness will be far worse at doing simple anagrams, for example, or my favourite, coming up with creative uses for a brick. and at home, it means you can't switch off and you're slightly grouchier. You won't be able to relax. Your sleep might be disturbed. Perhaps you will have an extra G&T, meaning that in the morning you're snappier. If you snap at your partner, they then take that rudeness with them to their workplace. And so these strains of rudeness are spreading over the world like a yawn we catch from each other.
Yeah, that's interesting because it almost seems kind of counterintuitive to me on one level, because you would think people witnessing rudeness would be more sensitive and not want to imitate it, you know, not want to be rude themselves, I would think, and say, geez, I want to be extra, make sure I'm not being rude to people.
Well, absolutely. And one scientist in particular, a guy called Dr. Amir Erez, who's a real expert in rudeness, he said he never believed in any of this stuff. He never believed in the effects of rudeness. And he started to do these experiments and these tests, and he says that every time he does, he finds something else, and it's just shocking. And he told me that it doesn't even have to be a huge moment of rudeness that you've witnessed. It can just be mildly rude words.
Wow.
Somehow these words bring about associations, memories or experiences, and it means that we are much more likely to be on edge, which is fine if you're a writer trying to buy a hot dog, but not great if you are a doctor who needs to concentrate and have full use of their frontal lobes. It's been shown that if a doctor experiences rudeness at the start of their day, the next five patients will be affected because the doctor is unable to concentrate in the same way. They are less able to take in new information, so they will fixate on the original diagnosis even when new evidence is coming in. Teams of surgeons have been shown through experiments done in Tel Aviv that if they experience rudeness, the teams that did would be 50% less effective at the surgery they were about to perform. They wouldn't be able to communicate with each other. They would pick up the wrong instruments, administer the wrong drugs. They wouldn't resuscitate properly. And in these simulations, they would have lost the lives of the people that the simulations were supposed to represent. This book started as quite a silly thing about a hot dog, but the further I got into it, the darker I found the effects of rudeness, because they're real and terrifying.
At one point, you became interested in the work of Dr. Brad Blanton, this psychotherapist who practices something that he calls radical honesty. And you actually interviewed Blanton and you asked him about how you should have acted during the hot dog incident, employing his principles of radical honesty. What did he tell you?
Well, he thought I went about things the wrong way because I was being polite. Politeness is my go-to. I think we should all be polite.
Absolutely.
I think etiquette is outdated, but politeness really is all we need. And that just means lubricating the day with, you know, pleases and thank yous. And if you can hold a door open for someone, you should. Blanton thinks that is deceitful. He thinks when I'm being polite to someone, I'm lying to them. If I don't say to them, I don't like your haircut and I'm not keen on you as a person, I am robbing our relationship of truth. Whereas I think I'm being empathetic and kind, and I would prefer to live in a world like that.
Yeah, me too.
But he says if we get rid of that layer of civility, then we're going to have a much more honest discussion with each other. And so I decided to attend a radical honesty workshop in Germany, a country known for its straight talking already.
Mm-hmm.
So I went, and I have to say, I tried radical honesty, and it was several of the most excruciating hours of my British life.
Why? What was so, in a nutshell, what was so bad about it?
Well, it's a bunch of people sitting around with no filter, basically, kind of being encouraged. Well, I'm not sure it's fair to say they're encouraged to be rude. They're encouraged to speak, and they're not encouraged to hide behind words.
So what advice do you have for us to help make the world less rude and more polite, especially since I'm Canadian and you're Scottish from Dundee, Scotland, but you live in the UK now. So we are considered among the most polite people. So I think it's kind of up to us to sort of set the tone, and you've done your part with this book and talking about it. But what can we in general do to make the world a more polite place and bring back a new kind of politeness?
Well, we can look out for each other. Mm-hmm. We can stand up for each other. We can shine a spotlight on rudeness when it happens. And we can defend strangers in the way that we would feel we would defend our friends. Very often, people, when they're being rude, they're doing so because they feel they can get away with it. Mm-hmm. They feel they're not part of the group, whereas the rest of us operate by these unwritten rules which unite this group. So when someone steps outside and they get away with it, very often we let them because we feel that somehow they must be special. They've earned the right to do it, whereas they haven't. And it degrades society. It coarsens it, and it chips away at civility. And so by reminding people gently and non-aggressively, sometimes with a joke or a smile or whatever you can do, you hold that looking glass up to them. Because mm-hmm. we're always looking into the eyes of other people for how we are doing. Does this person like me? Have I offended them? Am I doing all right in life? And when you look into that looking glass and you realize, wow, I've just been, yeah, no, I have actually been rude. It's quite a powerful thing.
Danny Wallace is the author of F You Very Much, Understanding the Culture of Rudeness and What We Can Do About It. That does it for this edition of Beta. Keep in touch with us during the week. Just send us an email to beta@wpr.org. Or you can follow us on Twitter @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
That's just flavor to a high life man.
Special thanks to our technical director and music director, Steve Gotcher.
I'm the dude, so that's what you call me.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Great guy. But useless.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
Doug, could you do it in a more pleasant voice this time?